Hello and welcome to The Rest Is Entertainment with me, Marina Hyde.
And me, Richard Osman, twice a week this week.
We are twice a week. We are formally beginning our questions sessions.
Questions and answers.
And answers, yeah. It won't just be us reading out your questions.
Originally, okay. I just thought, let's do questions. But do you know what? I listened to the producers. Yeah, they're right. Let's do answers as well.
I would say, do you want to begin? But I'm afraid I must begin with a little bit of housekeeping.
Okay.
On our Boxing Day episode where we began answering questions, I suggested that the first appearance of Boba Fett in the Star Wars holiday special, ill-fated and almost never seen again, made it canon. Thomas Aguirre-Fraga writes in to say, "Hello, I regret to reinforce stereotypes about Star Wars fans, particularly one on the male spectrum such as myself, but I feel the urge to write in to say that, very technically, the Star Wars holiday special was not the first appearance of Boba Fett. It is indeed the first on-screen appearance of Boba Fett, as the first broadcast of the Star Wars holiday special was November the 17th, 1978. However, on September the 24th, 1978, in the San Anselmo County Fair Day Parade, Boba Fett made his first public appearance. So I suppose Star Wars fans and pedants such as myself need truly to be considering Bay Area parades as canon." That is lovely. Thank you, Thomas. Wow. I stand correct. We all stand corrected.
And that's all we got time for today. It's been lovely. Do you know what? I'm not sure Thomas does regret reinforcing the stereotypes. I think he's happy to.
None of us ever regrets reinforcing
but also,
the stereotypes.
But also, if being in that parade, sorry to take this more seriously than it's than maybe we should, but if being that parade is canon, if that's the first appearance, then actually the person who made the costume, Like the first person to see Boba Fett was the first person like drew the costume.
Yeah,
So that's it. I mean, where do we go back to?
Where do we go back to? Where do we go back to? I think that's a question, but we don't necessarily want everyone to send in their answers to it.
Imagine if that's what this show was every week. It's all Boba Fett all the time. shall we try and move on to other areas?
Let us.
Or should we do another 20 minutes on Boba Fett?
Right.
Should we do our first question?
Yes. Sarah Cannon says, "What are your opinions on spoilers? Does it ruin your enjoyment of something if it gets leaked?"
Yeah.
It does, but I think there is a limit. I think someone actually wrote in and said, "I had no idea you shouldn't have mentioned a certain event in Succession because I'm just starting watching it now." And I thought, well, I mean, the clue is in the title a bit. And it was on the front of every single newspaper and all over social media for some weeks. It sort of had full cultural dominance. So in some cases, I think you have to be allowed to talk about a thing that has happened in a television show.
There has to be a statute of limitations. I once got in trouble on Pointless for giving away the plot of Great Expectations.
No.
And it feels to me like that probably is we should be allowed to talk about. There must come a
it's
point.
It's not clear when the limit is. I think it's a bit like pornography. You know it when you see it. It's the old... certainly as a writer, if I know what's happened or can work out what's happened, as I'm watching the thing on screen, I'm always thinking, how are they going to get there? How are they going to do it? Oh, I see. Yes, it does. I mean, it sort of takes away, doesn't it? But I do think there is a limit to how, in a kind of culture with social media and just any form of media, where you can't keep every single thing secret. And actually, you know, that's why linear isn't dead in lots of ways. People watch those new episodes of the very, very big shows. They try and watch them that night, the next night, and they stay away from social media in between.
Well, that's the thing. I don't like spoilers, but I don't like people who will go on Twitter and then say, "I can't believe you gave away the end of that." You think, yeah. I mean, honestly, if you really, really want to watch the end of, you know, whether it's Traitors or whether it's The Apprentice, whether it's Succession, and you're going to watch it tomorrow, do not go on Twitter tonight. That's really, really on you, I think. I think you have to. It's like there's the famous episode of Likely Lads where the boys trying to, you know, avoid the football result. Yeah. They do everything that they can do to avoid the football result so they can watch it on Match of the Day. Do you know what? It's got an interesting ending, that show, but I won't give away what that ending is in case people want to watch
we'll
it.
Also not.
And that's from the 70s. So, you know, perhaps I am more sensitive to spoilers. But I think Sarah goes on to say she likes spoilers. That she goes, she literally reads up on what happens.
She said that as an anxiety-reducing tool, she goes and reads ahead to find out what happens. But she is aware that that's unusual.
I really, really get that, though. I find it very hard to watch television programmes that are anxiety-inducing. I want to fast forward through to the bit where it's okay. If someone is wrongly accused of something, I cannot watch until it's been sorted out.
No.
I find it bearable. And like in my books, if there's moments of jeopardy, I sort them out pretty quickly because I like moments of jeopardy. But I'm not going to let something kind of just bubble for chapters and chapters and chapters because I find it too upsetting. You know, and it's interesting. Lots of new dramas and lots of comedies now where actually they dial down the jeopardy quite a lot. Or if there is jeopardy, it's solved quite quickly. And I think that's becoming a cultural thing because I think a lot of people find it very awkward to watch things that are tense. And so I'm with Sarah on
gosh, how interesting.
That. Yeah, but other than I
haven't been aware of that, but okay, I'm going to be looking out for it now.
Yeah, I wouldn't go to the very end. Like you don't want to find out who's won certain things.
No.
Do you? Or you know, one of the great joys is to be able to watch Match of the Day not knowing any of the results,
yeah.
Which these days is almost impossible. And also I would never do it cuz I need to know if Fulham have lost, which invariably they have. Very good question, though.
Right.
But I do think if you are deliberately spoiling things for people, that's a very, very bad
look.
That
is certainly a character note.
But, yeah, great expectations. I will not tell you what happens.
Okay, Nick Harnett writes, what does the job of showrunner entail and how is someone like Taylor Sheridan is the showrunner of Yellowstone, America's most popular show. Taylor's production company, 1901, by my calculation, made 5 to 6 Paramount shows last year, all massive productions. How is he able to sustain multiple productions at once? Well, the job of showrunner, which we'll begin with, this is a sort of, it's more of a US role, and we'll come to differences in the UK in a minute, but a showrunner is the creative authority on the show, the ultimate creative authority. Most likely they had the original idea and developed it. They may have developed it from source material, e.g. now Warners are looking for a showrunner for the Harry Potter series, which they're going to turn into one whole TV series per book.
That's a good idea. Where do they get their ideas from?
Well, in a way, they think their property is laying dormant for too long. So but the showrunner, it's a huge job. You are liaising, apart from overseeing all the writing and doing a lot of writing yourself, you're running the writer's room, you are dealing with the heads of departments. Every creative decision on that show comes through you. Taylor Sheridan is a specific case. He lives on a ranch, so I think Whoa. He's quite, and he writes a huge amount of Yellowstone. I think he's written something like 60 episodes of it, which is more than a lot of people will write of television in their entire careers.
And as you say, a show that we don't really know over here, but it's the biggest show
in America. It's the biggest show.
The Kevin Costner one, right?
Yes.
I think it's on 5 now.
Yes, I think it is now. Yeah. I think they have bought it. What I will say is that a lot of people you see get that many credits. The writer's room has broken the story. Writers have gone away and written first, second, multiple drafts. And then the showrunner might rewrite that and essentially take the credits. You can imagine what a lot of writers feel about this particular thing, but it's not something I've experienced, but a lot of people do, that does sometimes happen. So people can, it's really hard to be across everything. There's only so much of one person. So he hasn't got a sort of time turner, like what's the name in Harry Potter. He can't do it to the extent that someone like Jesse Armstrong would do on Succession.
Yeah, it's a weird combination of writer and producer,
yeah.
Isn't it? Showrunner, essentially. So in the UK, that would be writer and producer combined. In the UK, you always see executive producer, which always hides a multitude of sins.
Yeah, yes.
You know, it can literally be the person who's working hardest to someone who works in the office at the production company. There's an awful lot of hidden behind exec producers.
And in the US, it can mean writer, because the WGA have been so strong on getting credits for people that you can be created as the executive producer of a show on which you are effectively a writer, and you get production credits.
Well, that's it. On those Succession credits, all the exec producers are essentially the writers in the writer room.
Yes. But
the
most senior ones. But those most senior ones will also be in charge of being in charge of a lot of stuff on location, being doing more than just someone who is more junior in the writer's room is concerned.
I have a question. I like that your questions are about very, very high-end, incredibly expensive American drama, and mine are about daytime quizzes. This is from Dovir Udin. Are the questions on daytime daily quizzes weighted to ensure there isn't a daily payout, or are the questions selected randomly? I only ask because it seems to me it would be very expensive if the jackpot was won every day. Thank you, Dobbit. Well, it's a very good question. And the questions wouldn't be weighted particularly in that way, but lots of formats have ways of ensuring there isn't a payout. So you'll do it like a final round where you could win or you couldn't win the jackpot. So on Pointless, you don't win the jackpot every day. You win it every few days. On something like, you always have an algorithm. So in your budget, daytime budgets are very small, but in your budget will be a line item for prize money. So when we used to make Deal or No Deal, for example, which is a very good example because it's all about money,
yeah.
And you got that £250,000 box all the way down to the 1p box. Yep. And the average amount of money we were supposed to give away was £16,500 a day. So that's the thing, which means you can win a quarter of a million, but an awful lot of other people are going to have to win £2,000. It's the truth. And there's an algorithm that you put together for shows that give away a million. You can be insured as well in case your algorithm breaks. But yeah, so on Deal or No Deal, we know we got 16,000 to give away, which is quite a lot, given that a lot of people do crash and burn and, you know, walk away with 50 pence or walk away with £500. You know, you can be having those 50,000, 70,000 wins. Very, very few people, I think four or five in our run of it, go all the way and go for the £250,000. So you've got a 250,000 box. But the beauty of that format is you're left with £250,000 and £15, and you know you're going to be offered £70,000, and very few people are turning that down. You know, very, very few. Some people did, and you know it's great, but very few people are turning that down. Now it's interesting on the ITV reboot of it they just done with Stephen Mulhern, which is very good. There's no £250,000. Box. The highest box is £100,000. And that is because their daily payout is probably something around £12,000. So they can't afford to have that £250,000 in there. It's a algorithm. In fact, algorithm.
Can the algorithm break, like you just said?
Not really. Not really. That algorithm is weirdly written by the banker, the guy who was a banker, Glenn Hugel, who's a mathematical genius. And so, you know, that's his algorithm and it's worked for years and years and years and years. But we did a show called Million Pound Drop with Davina.
I remember.
For many years, which is a really good show. It was the best-selling show in the world for 3 years running.
Was it?
Million Pound Drop, the format, yeah.
Was that Endemol?
But back in the days where you could make money out of formats. You can't anymore. So we were doing that show and you're given £1 million. And you move it across various answers and across 10 questions, you gamble some of it, and you walk away. If you get to the last question, you walk away with whatever money you've got left. And our average payout for that, I think, was supposed to be 35, 40,000, something like that. Because it was prime time. So it was nice money. Because, again, a lot of people are leaving with nothing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can really bump it up. Literally the very first episode we did, the very first couple on the very first episode, this couple got all the way through to question 10 and they still had £500,000 on the table, which that's a problem for us because we got £40,000 an episode and we did like 12 episodes. So that's all of our prize money gone in one. And they had like a 50-50 question with £500,000. So you have to put all £500,000 on the same thing. And they put it on the wrong trapdoor.
Oh,
and
no.
They lost all of it, which awful for them,
yeah,
but absolutely saved the show.
If they'd won that in the first one, is there a sense also that it's downhill from there, that they won't do it as apart from the financial outlay of
you think,
would you have all felt that, okay, it's like someone winning a millionaire on the first episode?
That's the problem, is someone at some point can win £500,000.
Yeah.
But on the first episode, you're thinking, hold on,
it'll never be as good again.
But no, or have we got this wrong? Have we
the algorithm
worked? On that show, there are certain junctures at which you have a very difficult question where you're almost forced to split your money because you're asked, you know, which is the tallest building out of these four. And it's very, very difficult to have a definitive right answer. And so it's designed to make you spread your money. But this couple just happened to play it particularly brilliantly. Now, the problem would be is if, okay, we can give away this £500,000, but what if we then give away another £500,000 and then another £500,000? And the ashen faces as producers, we were quite happy because it's amazing telly. If they win or they don't win, but yeah, Channel 4 were like, what have we bought here? Yeah. You're gonna bankrupt us. But yeah, so by and large, if you watch lots of shows, you'll find some of them have end games where you can lose all your money. You know, pointless it is. We have, I think it's like £1,500 a day is our budget, so there's always £1,000 that goes up every day, and then, you know, extra money for pointless answers and things like that. We had to recently introduce a new round where you could add extra money to the jackpot because we were slightly under where we should have been on our jackpot. But, you know, people often say why is the prize money so bad on pointless, and the answer is because it's your money, it's paid for by the license fee.
Yeah.
But yeah, it all comes down to when it's commissioned by the channel, you have a number in that budget, which is your prize money number. And if you go over that, you probably have to make up the shortfall yourself. If you go massively over it and it's sort of everyone's fault, then you share that burden. But otherwise, that's coming out the bottom line of the production company, which production companies don't like.
No, I can imagine. Okay, Paul Leonard says, what percentage of books that have the film rights purchased ever get made? This is an interesting one because a huge percentage of films and TV are based on books as original material. But I am told by someone who works as an agent that about 1% of the books which are optioned, so that's the ones that they've actually paid for the rights are, ever make it to screen.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. An awful lot of books do get optioned because,
of course, your book is great. Your book, Thursday Murder Club, was optioned before it even was published.
Yes, and
bought by Steven Spielberg.
And bought by Steven Spielberg. And that's the interesting part is I've been around long enough to know that most books get optioned and very few books get made. Okay, and there's all sorts of reasons for that. Mainly, it's very difficult to get anything made in any genre anywhere.
Absolutely,
but it's actually quite cheap to option a book. So if you're a production company, you can pay $5,000 for certain books and have a year-long
just have them on the shelf,
option. And then, you can then extend the option another year if you've made progress and keep them on the shelf. Yeah, absolutely right. So when I was selling the rights to the Thursday Murder Club, as you say, before it came out, and Amblin, which is Spielberg's company, came in and said they'd like to buy it, what I'm thinking then is this book is never going to get made into a film. Because I know the numbers suggest that. However big a book might become, but most things don't get made into a film. So I think this is not going to get made into a film. However, I'm just about to go out and promote this book. And the fact that Steven Spielberg has bought the rights is a really,
nice
really
thing
good
to have
thing
in your
to
back pocket for but the
it
interview.
Is. It's kudos and he knows storytelling. And so for me, selling it to Amblin was literally, this is going to be helpful for me in selling this book in lots of different territories and all sorts of things. But I didn't think for a second it would ever get made. It turns out it is going to get made this year, which is very, very exciting. It's been quite a while.
The continuing hard luck story of this book.
Exactly.
Goodness me.
Yeah, goodness me.
This is a little book that could, isn't it?
Yeah,
really?
I mean, yeah. When am I going to get a break? it's getting made this year. But yeah, most things don't. It's with the streamers and stuff, there's more and more books are being made, and in the world I'm from, crime fiction and thrillers, there's actually quite a good sort of conversion rate. So it would be more than 1%, I think, for crime and thrillers, especially with the streamers. I think now the whole industry is contracting.
Yeah,
it might
go
back to
again.
That. But yeah, the truth is, it's quite cheap to buy the rights to a book. It's very, 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 very expensive to film a book. So in between those two numbers, there's an awful lot of drop off. And the way those things are structured are you'll get money for an 18-month option. They might then extend it if there's a little bit of interest. But again, it'll be at the same rate. But there's a purchase price on the first day of principal photography, which is essentially when the cameras start rolling. That's when the real money kicks in. But essentially, the production companies don't really have to spend very much at all to buy a book unless they actually start filming it, which at which point they're making money anyway. Yeah. Here is a question. I wonder if you can answer this because I don't have the answer to this. I suspect you might. Ruth Cousins asked this. Fast forwarding through the I'm a Celeb adverts, my 16-year-old daughter asked how much ads in a massive show like that cost. I have literally no idea, so I thought I would ask you.
Okay, it is about $300,000 for a 30-second spot on I'm a Celeb. And that is obviously probably the biggest real estate for advertising because it's such a huge show. I saw that Ruth also said, has the contents of ads changed now that advertisers know that at best they're viewed at 12 times speed? This is definitely something I feel a bit sad about because I feel like I grew up in a great age of TV advertising where we all sat there and we were hostages. We couldn't. There was barely anything to switch over to because there was relatively few channels.
The good old days.
And so you got those incredible. I'm someone like Jonathan Glazer who is. I'm going to keep banging on about Zone of Interest, which is this incredible film coming out in. So I think it's midway through February, start of February. But he was responsible for some of those, the Guinness Surfer ad, the Nike Parklife ad, the Sony Bravia where the whole paint tower exploded, the whole tower block exploded in colours and things like with paint.
Did he do We Hope It's Chips, It's Chips?
He did not do that one. But obviously there was a whole thing where lots of brilliant directors started in television commercials. I don't feel there's a scope anymore now. You sometimes see it with cinema adverts, but in general, advertising is like get the information out there as quickly as possible and often in writing on the screen because, as you say, Ruth, people are fast-forwarding through them and not watching them. And a phenomenon I noticed when my children were quite young, which was that when we even asked them what they wanted for Christmas, I would have an entire list as a child. Mm. I'd like things that I never got. I'd like the Barbie house, please. Yeah, you'll never get it, Marina. I'd like this. Everything that I'd seen on adverts on TV. My children never watched adverts. They didn't basically watch scheduled television. So they didn't really know things to ask for. And as you sort of took them to a toy shop, they hadn't seen things, yeah, which I thought was a real shift. Anyway.
I always wanted Scalextric.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Yes,
never got it.
Never got it.
Yeah. It's a shame, isn't it? Yeah. But 300 grand for a 30-second commercial.
That's quite long, a 30-second one. And yeah, you don't, you know, so you, not, they're not all paying 300 grand. But so you need to be the big, very, very big brands to do that.
And, you know, TV, linear TV advertising, which would be our big main channels, you know, declining hugely. So every story is, oh, the collapse of linear television, yeah, the collapse of... It's still massive. I mean, it's still sort of the most effective thing you can do to launch a brand or to keep a brand up. But it's, yeah, as you say, it's not what it was in the days of we hope it's chips.
Yeah. There is one thing which is bigger, which never obviously used to exist, which is sponsorships of shows. But brands sponsor shows because then they get that minute, the 20 seconds at the start when you're sitting down to watch and you will, you know, and it will go on the front, whether you're watching it catch up, whether you're watching it anything. So that is a much bigger business than it ever was.
And there's all sorts of legislation around how many adverts can be shown. I think an ITV hour, a commercial hour, is 46 minutes. A half hour would be 24 minutes. Mm. So you've got 6 minutes of adverts or 14 minutes of adverts. Someone who's in the show that's being advertised in is not allowed to do the voiceover, for example. Newsreaders are not allowed to do voiceovers, things like that. So all sorts of little rules. But yeah, that's why whenever you watch something on ITVXA or your 4 on Demand, if you pay to get rid of the adverts, they're all 46 minutes long.
Yeah.
If that, which is, you know, that's the rest of it is adverts. Let's take a £300,000 break, shall we?
Yeah.
Welcome back, everybody. Marina, I have a question from Christine Knight. I think this is a great question. With the rise in true crime podcasts and documentaries for entertainment, has there ever been a story told which, in your opinion, should have been left alone out of respect?
That's a really good question. It's how it turns out, which is whether or not you think it's been respected. I personally don't think anything should be off limits for art or creativity. Some of the true crime podcasts, I think, seem to me complete voyeurism and are awful. But that's just a question of execution. I don't think that anything should be beyond being tackled as a subject. One thing I would say over the past few years is that I'm very, very bored of the propensity for any story to become immediately two warring, almost immediately after it's happened, a crime story, two warring documentaries, then a book, and then a kind of Netflix drama. By the time you get to the end, I don't know, the Elizabeth Holmes story or something like that, you think, yeah, I think I'm across what happened on this one now. I think I'm across the con now. So I think that what will get scaled down in now, there's going to be probably half as many scripted shows as there were if we've passed the era of peak TV or whatever. But the documentaries will continue because they're much cheaper to make. It just depends on the execution. Actually, the recent ITV drama, The Long Shadow, or last year's drama, which was probably the first time that Yorkshire Ripper story had been told from the... Actually, the victims don't like the phrase, the Yorkshire Ripper, so my apologies for using it, but from the point of view of the women and the point of view of the families of the victims. And so that is an example of something where, yes, I think going back to that story yet again would just have been sort of salacious and we kind of know it, but doing it from that different angle put right lots of wrongs that maybe past dramas have wrought. And so I think that kind of... It just depends on the execution, but I don't think anything should be off limits.
Yeah, there's certainly some schlocky ones that when you start watching in 5 minutes and you're like, oh, this, yeah, I suspect this is not for me. And that's difficult. You can't really legislate against it. But yeah, again, there's an ITV one, The Sixth Commandment, the Timothy Spall one, about the awful sort of narcissist who moved in with old people and killed them. And it was so beautifully done. I was talking about my wife and I listen to lots and lots of true crime podcasts. And I think one of the things you can take from it is there is an undercurrent in lots of them of very troubled narcissistic human beings who then become awful and controlling. You know, that seems to be a subset of
is that the podcasters I sometimes feel.
Well, listen, no comment. But I think it's quite useful sometimes in working out who the people are who commit crimes. And I think so long as a podcast nails its colours to the mast very early, which is this is about the victim, I'm talking to the victim's family and they're happy to talk to me and they understand why I'm doing what I'm doing, then I'm always very, very happy to listen to them. But yeah, the cautionary tales, I suppose. But yes, occasionally you'll listen to podcasts and there's sort of a glee in people's voices, or it's clear that the investigative reporter wants to be the star of the podcast, and you just think this...
I like the way it's sent up in Only Murders in the Building, where Tina Fey plays a sort of absolutely kind of exploitative... I think she's got a sort of about six franchises of crime podcast by this point. So I think, yes. But obviously, at the kind of lowest level, I would say it is honestly people just turning up to crime scenes saying, I'm doing a podcast, and they've just got an iPhone, and I just don't think that's obviously remotely acceptable.
I know, you hear from the police these days, they're saying every single time there's any sort of investigation, there's like
horrendous
five podcasters.
TikTokers. Those people should, if it's honestly just you doing it for TikTok, then I don't think that that is something that should be democratized down to that extent. I think whenever covering stuff like crime, you should have a whole structure where you can put the content you're creating through various checks and balances, and it can be questioned ethically. And I just don't think one person acting alone can do that.
Thank you, Christine. Great question.
Okay, here's a good one. Paul O'Connor says, why do all children in American film and TV shows have to sound like adults? Usually adults with insight into the particular problems of their parents' guardians. Is it just American scriptwriters who seem incapable of accepting that children are children?
Mm. Well, it's hard, isn't it? Because you need every character in something to do a job for you. And they've got to move the story on or be insightful one way or another. And that thing of, if I put these words in the mouth of an innocent child, perhaps they'll carry extra weight. It's
well, I'm afraid to say that I think American children can deliver those lines. This is a very unpopular opinion, what I'm nervous of voicing, and yet here I am. I think American children wipe the floor in terms of acting with British children. I just don't really think British children can act. Really think there's something in American culture. Maybe it's having, you know, kind of dominated global culture. They entertainment culture for the sort of latter half of the 20th century. They sort of know how to say lines. They're kind of instinctive performers. I remember seeing Millie Bobby Brown on Stranger Things and thinking, wow, she's very good. Someone said she's British, and I thought, what? Hang on, my theory's broken. Then I had a look. Oh, raised completely in America. Well, there you go. British kids can't act.
Did your daughter get turned down for the EastEnders audition?
No, but look, look at the George and Harry Potter. I'm sorry, but they honestly get worse as the show as the series goes on.
I think British child actors have gotten an awful lot better. There's some amazing stuff. By the way, there's an amazing Harlan Coben's show, Fool Me Once, is brilliant on Netflix. There is a 2-year-old kid in that who absolutely steals every single scene she's in. She is amazing. She's got no lines, because she's two, but she's absolutely brilliant.
Next question is from Andy Williams. He says, based on your recent discussion, read the need for hard comedies on TV, is that the rationale for the continual recommissioning of the awful Mrs. Brown's Boys? Is there a market out there for this programme, or is there something I'm missing re its export value? Seems to me a very little artistic or comedic merit, so I'm really interested in your views on why it may be so popular and why it survives.
Oh, Andy Williams has changed since You're Just Too Good to Be True, hasn't he? We talked about hard comedy, and hard comedy essentially just means comedy that people, like proper old-fashioned comedy that people are going to laugh at, not kind of smart-assed, you know, comedy, but just kind of very mainstream comedy. It's a good question, but it's people find Mrs. Brown's Boys very difficult. This is what I would say about it. There are an awful lot of comedies that, certainly used to be 10 years ago, released every year in Britain. Most of them don't exercise people, and the reason they don't exercise people is because nobody watched them and they disappeared and they didn't go for another series. The reason that Mrs. Brown's Boys upsets people so much is because it was wildly popular and it was wildly successful. I mean hugely successful. Yeah. And the reason it was hugely successful is because of all the shows that are a bit like Mrs. Brown's Boys, it was the best. And it was done by a cast of people who've acted together for years and who've done theatres for years. And it was done with a sort of glee that was absent from a lot of other television programmes. And it was done maybe from a different perspective of humour from other television programmes. So it was something that had been massively underrepresented. There were an awful lot of very, very clever comedies coming out 10 years ago. You know, the Fleabags.
Well, not represented for a while. It's clearly a nostalgic thing to it all. It's that old studio audience kind of comedy that you just don't see anymore.
Exactly that. And done well. And I don't people don't want to hear that because...
It rates well. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep recommissioning it.
Also, if you don't like it, if you don't like that humour, none of it is going to win you over. But Brendan O'Carroll, who is Mrs. Brown, is a brilliant performer, writer.
It's not a woman.
Mrs. Brown is not a woman.
What?
Which, again, was very, very ahead of the curve.
Can we stop, please? I mean, I'm going to need a moment to process this.
Firstly, you're saying Mrs. Brown's voice is good, and now Mrs. Brown herself is a man.
I noticed
man.
You didn't. Yes, carry on.
So I think it's a brilliantly put together bit of television. And if you don't like it, you are going to absolutely hate it because it has the courage of its convictions. It does what it does to the absolute nth degree. And it is greatly loved by viewers, which is there's nothing more infuriating.
If I can just break another little bit of news since we're in the exclusives game, there is other TV. I mean,
exactly.
It's fine not to watch it.
Exactly that.
Yeah. I personally don't watch it, but there's plenty of other things for me.
Marina, you shock me. But if this is the sort of thing you don't like, then it is infuriating that it is so popular. You know when you watch a show that everybody seems to love and you're like, I'm sorry, I don't get what this is at all. And it really, really is enraging sometimes where you go, how are people missing the fact that this isn't good? And the truth is, maybe it is good. It's just there's something about one's own sensibility that means you don't like it. It's like when you look at the replies to a tweet and you go, hold on, everyone's an idiot?
I really want to know the answer to this. Lily Williamson writes, I'm an avid watcher of cooking shows and competitions, but I'm always flummoxed as to how the food looks so fresh or warm for the judges or critics to try when they obviously can't eat or film everything at once. Can you explain the process of the judging sections, please, if you have any insights? I would love to know those.
Yeah, well, my only insight from the few cooking shows I've been around is the food is cold.
You give it a bit
of a spray to make it look a bit glossy, and it's well lit.
The food stylists. With a little bit of oil.
They're essentially eating cold food, which on Bake Off is fine.
Yeah.
That's why Bake Off is the truest of all those formats. But also, the judges know. They can judge semi-lukewarm food, can't they?
Yes, I guess.
Let's pitch a show to the BBC called Can You Judge Semi-Lukewarm Food?
Have you seen that? Is It Cake on Netflix?
Yeah, I love Is It Cake. Mm. Yeah.
Yes.
And again, no problems there. That was a lot of fun.
That was brilliant. The questions are so good. There are so many of them.
We will get through as many as we can. Exactly. But do please send others if you wish. therestisentertainment@gmail.com. And we'll be doing the same next week. So we'll be back on Tuesday with a regular episode.
Yes. And then on Thursday with more questions.
Ah, see you next week, everyone.
Bye-bye.